Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa with the News Gazette, dated Wednesday, January 29th, 2025. How are you today? Hope you're having a great Wednesday. This is the front page we'll start with, and on the front page is quite a large section of a picture of five people, and alongside each of the people, there's a short bit of information, and the whole article is entitled Five Who Thrived. It's from the CU Schools Foundation by Jeff D'Alessio. Two Centennial Chargers, a pair of Urbana Tigers, and one Central Maroon will share the spotlight on April 11th at the iHotel and Conference Center when the Champaign-Urbana Schools Foundation honors Unit 4 and District 116 alumni whose achievements, strength of character, and citizenship serve as role models to inspire and challenge today's youth. Here's your first look at this year's winners. And the first one is Jennifer Lansford. Centennial 91, the daughter of U of I professor and Unit 4 teacher, has made her own mark in education, serving as a research professor at Duke Center for Child and Family Policy, and since 2008, leading an international team of peers in 9 countries, studying child development and parenting in different cultural contexts. A former Scholem Pool swim instructor and Krannert regular, Lansford's list of impactful teachers includes Topper Steinman, inspired her interest in psychology, Georgine Hembro, inspired her interest in culture and international work, George Valentine, made learning fun and interesting, and Elsie Eggenhaupt, made her a stronger writer. Next, we have distinguished alumni Donna Tanner Harold. She graduated from Central in 72. This makes 2 high honors in a month for the alumni of Marquette Elementary, Edison, and Central, who was presented with the Doris Hoskins Prestigious Community Service Award at the MLK Countrywide Celebration. A retired Parkland College counselor and founder of Champaign County's first treatment foster care program, Tanner Harold is renowned locally for developing one innovative program after another, a parenting and life skills course for incarcerated women, a Black Student Youth Success Project, and the Black Mental Health and Wellness Conference among them. Her proudest feat? Watching each of my 4 children earn graduate degrees. Next, distinguished alumni Dr. Susan Nagel, Urbana 73. I cannot think of another person who has done more to make the lives of those with whom she has worked better, nominator David Thies says of the medical missionary, humanitarian, and winner of the American Medical Association's 2012 Medal of Valor for courage under extraordinary circumstances. After joining Maryknoll lay missionaries in 1984, Nagel served in Tanzania, South Sudan, Kenya, and Mombasa, leading efforts in tuberculosis treatment, primary health care, and hospital development. Among her fondest high school memories, UHS debuting girls tennis her senior year after the 1972 passage of Title IX. The tennis courts at Blair Park were my second home. Up next, local business community impact, Brett Shaw, from Centennial 07. The Garden Hills, Jefferson, and Centennial grad might not be where he is today, president of Champaign's Shaw Lux Premier Renovations, if not for one impactful teacher. When I lost my mother in high school and I could have given up, Connie Brillhart brought me in, treated me like a son, invested in me, helped me through a dark time, checked on me every day, and kept me going strong. Years later, Shaw has paid it forward, nominator Kathy MacArthur notes. Recognizing the inequity between boys and girls' locker rooms at Central High School, he and his team at Shaw Lux went beyond a simple paint job, providing a full makeover at no cost to the Boosters athletic program or Unit 4. Next, Robert Lewis, Urbana 64. Among the former Salem Baptist music tutor's greatest hits, playing in the Douglas Center Drum Corps as a child and co-founding the Mobetta Music Program and Banks, Bridgewater, and Lewis Fine Arts Academy as a grown-up, mentoring countless young musicians along the way. The lifelong percussionist's remarkable contributions have left a profound and lasting impact on generations of students and families in Champaign-Urbana, and extend beyond the arts. An engineer with two patents to his credit, he invented a plastic structural system for seating intended to shift demand away from lumber. Lewis also represented Ward 3 on Urbana City Council. And those were the five winners of the CU Schools Foundation honoree of acknowledging the Distinguished Alumni. Next, we're going to Champaign School Board. This is still on the front page. Boozer, are you trying to run me out of here? Unit 4 Superintendent expresses frustration over board requests. From Champaign by Jeff D'Alessio. What's left of the Champaign School Board got down to business this week, voting to send the $1.1 million Centennial Softball Field project out to bid, agreeing on the process for picking a short timer to fill Sam Banks' vacant seat and signing off on tweaks to the 2025-26 Student Code of Conduct. And then, in hour five of Monday's meetings, things took a turn for the heated, as they so often do. During the board comment portion of the marathon meeting, member Amy Armstrong rattled off some of the requests she made in 2024 and still hadn't received answers to. Among them, the number of long-term substitute teachers working in the district, a list of all administrators with salary and experience levels, data on the rise in workers' compensation cases and payouts in the district, and updates on a variety of topics, including all job openings, how the district was spending its cuts of funding from the City of Champaign's gun violence reduction blueprint, and process reports on Garden Hills Academy and Booker T. Washington STEM Academy, the latter following the superintendent's call for district employees to voluntarily transfer to the shorthanded elementary school in the fall. That's a lot of information you've been asking for, responded Superintendent Sheila Boozer, adding of the BTW and Garden Hills. I think it's presumptuous, is the best word I can use, to state that we need to do something for our two most marginalized schools. We have to be very careful what message we're sending to those staff members and those families. I expressed my concerns about that. She wasn't done. I hate to say it, but I'm going to say it. I do feel like it's a gotcha, Boozer said. It has been ongoing for a year and a half now. We have not had a full staff of people and do some of these things and actually do the work we're supposed to do on a day-to-day basis. So I really need to know where this is coming from, why we need all these questions answered, and can a conversation be more beneficial than trying to figure out what you're asking me? And I'm saying this respectfully. I don't understand where all this is coming from. This is very difficult to try to run a district and also maneuver work with the dysfunction that is prevalent here on the board. It's very difficult and it's daunting, and it's creating a very hostile working environment, and my team is worn out. We're trying to make sure our kids can read, they can do math, we're taking care of staffing, we're trying to make sure we're doing all of these things. I am brilliant, and I know I am, and I know what I'm doing, Boozer said. But I cannot play guess what I'm thinking today, because this is very difficult and it's not fair. Armstrong reiterated that the questions she posed weren't new ones, but rather holdovers from last year, Boozer said. With all the dysfunction that started last year. Armstrong, I can appreciate that. I can. Boozer, I think we just need to have a conversation about what the full board wants, because I get six different things sometimes. You send me 17 questions. Board member Betsy Holder sends me 22 questions. I don't know what I'm supposed to do, and I need to know. Is this what the whole board wants, or are these just individual projects? Are you trying to run me out of here? Boozer asked. I don't know what's going on. I'm just speaking. And on it went, with Armstrong noting, these are actually material to the functioning of the district going back several months, and Boozer bringing the conversation back to BTW and Garden Hills and why the focus was on them. The community is asking. When teachers ask and I follow up, Armstrong said. Then Board President Giannina Baker joined in, saying, teachers should go to their building administrator. I'm not going to be vilified for asking questions, Armstrong said. It's my responsibility, and I'm following up. Your responsibility is board work, and what you've asked, much of it is staff work, Baker shot back. Armstrong, who preceded Baker as board president, then asked for a special meeting to be scheduled so members could get a better handle on the district's legal bills, noting the concerning number of Freedom Information Act denials that attorneys were brought in on. Special meetings were called regularly. During her tenure as president, Armstrong has pointed out on several occasions and are required under state statute to be scheduled whenever two board members ask for them. Will you please stop with the special meetings? Baker said. You want a special meeting every other week. Holder chimed in. We haven't had any. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Baker said, turning to Armstrong, but you are not the board president at this moment. You can laugh all you want. Armstrong, I'm not laughing. Baker, you are laughing. You literally are. I ask for things to be placed on the agenda for how it gets done because it's been multiple requests over time, specific for special board meetings, to have a conversation, and it doesn't get followed through on, Armstrong said. So, it's a very simple request to ask, how does this happen? That's where the back and forth wrapped up, save for Heather Vasquez referring to Armstrong as the person who asked 26 questions, suggesting they be prioritized and ending with a wow. As for who will fill the board seat vacated in December by Banks, who became the third member in 10 months to resign, Monday brought a little more clarity. Over Holder's objections, it was decided that three applicants, Joseph Abreets, Okiami Clemens, and Kelly Ransom, would be invited to interview at a public meeting on February 3rd. The assignment is a short-term one, with only a handful of meetings on the calendar before someone is elected to fill the two-year term on April the 1st. Holder briefly reiterated her case on Monday, calling it unnecessary measure and proposing we just do the basic business and keep moving until the next board is seated. Armstrong and Holder, both elected in 2023, will be the lone holdovers. And the last article on the front page is from Urbana by Luke Taylor with the heading American Cancer Society, author joining Illini coach to highlight fight against cancer. When Isaac Scher lost his job because his employer no longer wished to accommodate his medical needs, he saw the writing on the wall that it was his chance to seriously pursue a career as an author. Less than a year later, he has two books and a short story to be published. After my initial diagnosis, I started to refocus on what had originally just been, this might be fun, it might be a hobby, Scher said. Having what I like to refer to as the axe at your neck of cancer, got me motivated to really get that happening. A former theater student and convention founder, Scher is no stranger to the spotlight he'll be under as he joins Illini basketball coach Brad Underwood in supporting the American Cancer Society's Coaches vs. Cancer initiative on Saturday. Underwood is also participating in the Coaches vs. Cancer Suits and Sneakers Week, with an annual effort to raise awareness and encourage people to get screened for cancer. Scher will specifically be highlighting the Society's Road to Recovery program, which he says has been a game changer for his ability to access medical care. In 2018, he was diagnosed with glioblastoma multiforme, an aggressive form of brain cancer. Less than half of the patients survive a year after diagnosis, and less than 20% survive 2 years. I've been exceptionally fortunate in that I responded very well to the treatment, Scher said. He was in remission for years before the cancer returned in 2023, and he had to undergo another round of surgery and further chemotherapy. Last year, sure, his wife and their son moved from Chicago to Champaign for more affordable housing, shortly before he learned that the glioblastoma was back and would be inoperable. His condition is stable thanks to medication, but minor eyesight damage from prior surgeries combined with a pre-existing mild seizure risk led Scher's doctor to suggest he avoid driving unless absolutely necessary. Scher has fairly frequent hospital visits to monitor and treat his condition, so his oncologist suggested he check out the Road to Recovery program. There's some weeks where I have like 3 appointments with different doctors. It adds up, Scher said. This Road to Recovery program is really important to my finances. All he has to do is enter the time of his upcoming appointment into the app, and volunteers will pick up those rides requests to get him there. If no volunteers are available, the app notifies him at least 24 hours in advance to make other arrangements. Rideshare apps like Uber or Lyft might not be as expensive in Champaign-Urbana as back in Chicago, but the cost can quickly add up after numerous trips. It's been such a big help that when the American Cancer Society asked Scher if he would be interested in sharing his story, he was happy to agree. His theater degree and years as Masters of Ceremonies for Anime Central both helped reduce stage fright, but they also both speak to his desire to be a storyteller. I was already fully literate at age 3, so I was an early reader, just devouring books as a kid, Scher said. Scher's first published work was a short story about He-Man, which his teacher put up on the wall in her classroom. Later, he got into storytelling through games like Dungeons and Dragons and continued to be inspired by anime as a medium, but especially anything sci-fi or fantasy. That led to his first actual published book, A Cloak of Blades, which he says marries fantasy, sci-fi, action, and romance. Copies are available online or at the local author fair at the Champaign Public Library on February 5th. He has 2 more books scheduled to publish this year. Unconventional, which tells the story of a romance at a fan convention, and Thy Eternal Summer, a romance story inspired by his own life-changing trip to Japan. Beyond his pure love for writing, Scher said that he's inspired to find a way to support his family after he's gone. It's important to him to stay positive and provide for his family, so that he made his own addition to the popular F Cancer slogan called F Despair. I'm lucky to have lived for as long as I did. There are days where despair jumps out and goes, "By the way, you know you're going to die, right?" Scher said. "I refuse to give in to despair. It helps nothing and no one." And we have an article under the title, under the heading of the business page, under agriculture, with the title Excruciating Prices. Thanks to bird flu, the cost of eggs is soaring. Don't expect that to change anytime soon, USDA officials warn. From Omaha, Nebraska, by Josh Funk, Mark Van Cleve, and Deanne Durbin. Bird flu is forcing farmers to slaughter millions of chickens a month, pushing U.S. egg prices to more than double their cost in the summer of 2023. And it appears there may be no relief in sight, given the surge in demand as Easter approaches. The average price per dozen nationwide hit $4.15 in December. That's not quite as high as the $4.82 record set 2 years ago. But the Agriculture Department predicts prices are going to soar another 20% this year. Shoppers in some parts of the country are already paying more than double the average price, or worse, finding empty shelves in their local grocery stores. Organic and cage-free varieties are even more expensive. Some grocery stores have even limited how many eggs shoppers can buy. It's just robbery, said Minneapolis resident Sage Mills, who bought eggs to make a birthday cake last week. Eggs used to be kind of a staple food for us, but now, you know, you might as well just go out to eat. What is driving the prices? The bird flu outbreak that started in 2022 is the main reason egg prices are up so much. Anytime the virus is found on a poultry farm, the entire flock is slaughtered to help limit the virus spread. And with massive egg farms routinely housing more than 1 million chickens, just a few infections can cause a supply crunch. The problem tends to linger because it takes months to dispose of all the carcasses, disinfect barns, and bring in new birds. More than 145 million chickens, turkeys, and other birds have been slaughtered since the current outbreak began, and the vast majority of them being egg-laying chickens. Cage-free egg laws in 10 states may also be responsible for some supply disruptions and price increases. The law sets minimum space for chickens or cage-free requirements for egg-laying hens. They've already gone into effect in California, Colorado, Massachusetts, Michigan, Oregon, Nevada, and Washington. At a Target in Chicago on Monday, a dozen large conventional eggs cost $4.49, but a dozen large cage-free eggs were selling for $6.19. Why is the virus so hard to control? Bird flu is primarily spread by wild birds, such as ducks and geese, as they migrate. While it is fatal to a variety of animals, these species can generally carry it without getting sick, which offers the virus a chance to mutate and thrive. The virus can be spread through droppings or any interaction between farm-raised poultry and wild birds. It's also easily tracked into a farm on someone's boots or by a vehicle. Unlike previous outbreaks, the one that began in 2022 didn't die out in high summer temperatures. The virus found another new host when dairy cattle started getting sick last March. That creates more opportunities for the virus to linger and spread. And unlike poultry, cattle aren't slaughtered when they get sick because they rarely die from bird flu. Since March, more than 5 dozen people have also become ill with bird flu, and one person has died. Nearly all of them worked around sick animals. Health officials haven't found yet evidence of the disease spreading from person to person. Let's check in with J. Mark Powell in his Holy Cow History with an article featuring the picture of a log cabin and the title, "The Log Cabin Lincoln Wasn't Born In." Lincoln's birthday's coming up. It's our annual reminder about the president born in a humble log cabin. Every year, some 200,000 people trek to Kentucky backwoods to visit a national shrine. They walk up 56 steps into a granite and marble structure inspired by the temples of ancient Greece. There they find a tiny log cabin made of hand-hewn logs with no window or floor and only a mud-daubed chimney for heat. A good many of those visitors are school kids. The lesson is, look at the great things accomplished by the man who started life in this lowly log cabin. It's an inspiring story. There's just one problem. Lincoln was no more born in that cabin than the man in the moon was. How it wound up inside a magnificent monument is curiously amusing and totally American. Yes, Abraham Lincoln was born in a log cabin on the Sinking Spring Farm in Kentucky on February 12, 1809. His father built it himself when the future president was two and the family moved to another farm down the road. Lincoln later said he had no memory of the place. In fact, he was embarrassed by his dirt poor days, explaining his lineage was best summed up in the phrase, "the short and simple annals of the poor." Others may have made a big deal of his family's poverty. Lincoln distanced himself from it. In 1860, he was what today would be considered a corporate attorney, as well as the infant Republican Party's second presidential nominee. Its public relations men knew a good gimmick when they saw one and branded him the rail splitter, for he had cut wooden rails used in fences to make ends meet as a young man. They also played up the fact that he had been born in a log cabin. Some GOP leaders wanted to resurrect a stunt used by William Henry Harrison supporters 20 years earlier and display Lincoln's birth cabin at campaign rallies, but despite searches, the cabin wasn't found. After Lincoln saved the Union in the Civil War and was assassinated and became an American icon, his log cabin birth followed him into the hereafter as part of the mystique. In 1895, a light bulb went off in entrepreneur Alfred Dennett's imaginative brain. excuse me, imaginative brain, he took logs from an old cabin found in the general area where Lincoln was believed to have been born, and voila! Lincoln's birthplace suddenly appeared. Dennett constructed an 18 by 16 foot cabin and charged admission at fairs and exhibitions for locals to gaze in wonder at the sacred structure. It was so lucrative that, wouldn't you know it, in 1897, Dennett's mysteriously turned up the Lincoln Log Cabin that Confederate President Jefferson Davis was supposedly born in 7 months earlier and only 100 miles away from Lincoln's nativity. He toured his new doubleheader attraction around the country. At one point, the railroad flat car carrying the pair derailed, and the logs from each cabin wound up in the other when they were rebuilt. The display eventually landed at New York City's Coney Island, celebrated some of hawkers and hucksters. Celebrated home of hawksters and hucksters. When the 20th century dawned, some people became outraged at seeing the great emancipator's birthplace treated like a carnival freak show feature. A movement began to move it to a more dignified setting. So, in 1906, the Lincoln Farm Association commenced a fundraising campaign. Mark Twain even got in on it, penning an editorial in the New York Times that laid it on thick. And this man sprung from Southern poor whites, born on a Kentucky farm and transplanted to an Indiana village. This man, in whose heart knowledge and charity had left no room for malice, was marked by Providence as the one to bind up the nation's wounds. His birthplace is worth saving, Twain wrote. And the money flowed in. Children eagerly responded, donating thousands upon thousands of pennies in the days just before Lincoln began appearing on the coin in 1909. In all, $350,000 was donated, worth about $10 million today. President Theodore Roosevelt laid the cornerstone for the memorial building at what is now known as the Abraham Lincoln Birthplace National Historical Park on February 12, 1909, the 100th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. President William Howard Taft led 3,000 people in celebrating its dedication on November 9, 1911. The National Park Service, which runs the site, now delicately sidesteps the authenticity issue, calling it the symbolic birth cabin, while diplomatically pointing out Lincoln's many accomplishments. Visitors still make the long trip down to Kentucky backroads to remember the very place Lincoln tried so hard to forget. And the article includes a picture of the log cabin, which is housed in the at the historical park. It says the symbolic birth cabin in the memorial building at Abraham Lincoln Birthplace National Historical Park near Hodgenville, Kentucky. And then there's also a picture of the beautiful neoclassical building which houses the small log cabin, and it's called the Memorial Building. Is a Beaux-Arts neoclassical building designed by John Russell Pope and constructed between 1909 and 1911. It features 16 windows, 16 rosettes on the ceiling, and 16 fence poles in reference to Lincoln being the 16th president. And the 56 steps leading to the entrance represents his age when he was assassinated in 1865. And an article under our communities with the heading, Former University Rehabilitation Center of CU. New owners look to reopen site as another nursing home, by Jana Wiersema from Urbana. Despite previous reports that opening another nursing home at the former University Rehabilitation Center of CU site would not be feasible, the property's new owners are eyeing the possibility. County records show that Ayodhya Dham Urbana LLC has purchased the property at 500 Art Bartel Road in Urbana for $1.5 million. We haven't solidified any concrete plans with the building, said Deepak Patel, a managing member of the group. We're interested in working with nursing home operators, though we haven't decided on anyone specifically. At the moment, we're renovating the building and considering what to do with it, as many nursing home operators are indeed interested. He added that they look forward to getting this building up and running in full capacity and servicing the needs of our community. Champaign County Executive Steve Summers told the News Gazette he was very surprised to hear that the new owners might try to open a nursing home at the site. The county received $150,000 after the property was sold to Ayudhya Dham Urbana LLC on November 25th. Summers told the News Gazette that most, if not all, of these funds will likely be used to offset the cost of outside counsel retained for this matter. And I'm going to end here with the first half of our News Gazette on January 29th. I'll be back to read the second half in just a moment.